Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. I'm like four. Jitter's ready. Stand by.
Everyone, welcome to this episode of Bullets and Bourbon. I'm joined by my co-host, Frank Gao, and we got a special guest, Jonathan Selinsky. Now, John is a Marine Corps sniper, former Marine Corps shooting team member, a State Department firearms instructor, and an avid competitor in 22 PRS and PRS. He's a solid dude with a wide range of experience. Before we get any further, John, can you kind of do a quick introduction to yourself?
So I got my competitive kind of start at my first Marine Corps combat marksmanship competition before they were kind of straight into the mix when I was still stationed out in Hawaii with 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. And then from there, the bug kind of bit me, and I got offered a spot on the shooting team, PCS'd out to them out in 2016, and then was put on the rifle team just due to my sniper background. And then I competed in mainly bullseye style competitions, and then kind of, I'm not going to say spearheaded because it was on and off for the entire time I was on the team, but kind of got the team started ish in PRS and more of the dynamic precision competitions. Did that for the 3 years I was on the team. Became head coach my second season and coached the precision rifle team for 2 years. And then I got out. And then once I got out, I continued to compete because it is an addiction. Absolutely. A very, very expensive addiction. Drugs are cheaper. But I kind of continued with that. I shoot about 30-ish matches a year, give or minus a couple. And I've picked up a couple of sponsors, but I've been doing that for the last 5 years since I got out. Now work for the State Department as a firearms instructor. I instructed for Rural Protective Services for a while. Kind of did different things here and there, but competitive shooting has kind of always been my one constant since I've gotten out of the Marine Corps.
No, that's awesome. And, you know, kind of mentioned it already, but we've known each other for about 7 years now. Mm-hmm. Most of our listeners are from the three-gun USPSA crowd. And as previously stated, you got your start into competitive shooting through the Marine Corps Marksmanship Program. Can you describe how invaluable that program was to your growth within the firearms industry?
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, like I said, that was kind of the initial bite that got me into the competitive circuit, which for the military is a rare thing, right? It's very important for those unit competitions to exist so that people can kind of learn what they don't know, right? Because you don't know what you don't know. And getting over that hurdle from never having competed and thinking you're the top dog in your little tiny pond, and then getting into competitive shooting is a huge hurdle for most people, particularly military and law enforcement. One of the hardest things to do is get people to show up to their first match and then come back when they get their dick stomped into the ground by like a 13-year-old just because their dad is like had the basics and taught them and they got the right mentorship and they're a phenomenal shooter. And then they show up and they just wipe the floor with all these wannabe operators, actual operators, and then egos get hurt and then they don't want to come back. And so it's getting over that initial hurdle. And the MCMICs are really, really good for that on the Marine Corps side. I know the Army has their own competitions that they run branch internal. And those are great because it kind of puts everyone a little bit more on an even playing field, right? Where when you go to a civilian competition, most of them are going to drastically outperform military law enforcement, even people with a significant amount of training, just because it's a different skill set and it's tweaked, right? We have specialized equipment, we have specialized holsters, it's specialized props. Everyone knows what they are. And if you're coming from a tactical background, it's a little bit different. But that was really the catalyst for me to get into competitive shooting, which is kind of let me branch off in a whole bunch of different things in the firearms industry. I write reviews for a couple of different companies and very largely involved with long range tactics. which is a big Facebook group essentially aimed towards helping beginners. We kind of started that based off of our frustrations with other groups that just kind of shat all over new shooters because they were asking what was perceived as dumb questions. And that is the quickest way to kill your own community is to not actually help new people. So we started our own group called Long Range Tactics. We do reviews. We've done instructional videos. And then we just have the group to pass information. And then I picked up a couple of sponsors along the way. And then I do my own training courses for PRS, mainly with Rimfire. Part of that is just due to range restrictions and the ease of being able to instruct with Rimfire versus centerfire. But all of those skills directly translate to the centerfire side as well.
And on the instructor side, you just purchased or you're purchasing a large swath of land where you can basically start your own facility and bring people in on your own property and train them, right?
Yeah. So that's actually closed. Closed a couple of months ago. I purchased 88 acres out near Gladstone, Virginia. It's not a perfect rectangle like I would like for a great centerfire range. It's kind of an odd shape, but you can take what you can get when it comes to land prices. But I do plan on kind of turning that into a range facility specifically for me to instruct, potentially for me to run rimfire matches at, and do some centerfire training as well.
What kind of range do you have now? Like, is it like pockets of open, clear land and then pockets of like deeply forested area?
For the property or what I use now for training?
Yeah, for the
property. So the property is completely cleared. That was part of the reason I got such a good deal on it was they were finishing logging it. And so it has, out of 88 acres, it might have 50 trees left on it, just in spots they couldn't get to them. But I've got a nice little kind of draw on the back half of the property, like the back 30 acres, that's going to be perfect to set up a permanent rimfire range. Where I can essentially set up an L shooting into the draw, and I'm going to permanently emplace props, and each one will be able to set up a lane that can go out to between 150 and 200. And then down the long axis of it, I'll be able to go to about 350. And then if I shoot across the entire property, I should be able to get to about 600 relatively easily, but it's not enough space to run like a match. I could run an instructional clinic where we have one or two lanes, but I won't be able to run a centerfire match on the property.
So more geared for the 22 PRS type crowd, which ain't a bad thing because I mean, I've only shot one 22 PRS match, but it is fucking fun.
Oh, like, it's a hugely addictive and it is a giant rabbit hole.
Yes. So, you know, kind of going back toward the shooting team stuff. While on the team, you already stated you were on the rifle team, and specifically during that time, the team pretty much competed in only high power. What lessons would you say were most valuable to your growth as a shooter, and what billets did you hold while you were on the team?
Okay. So yeah, we shot a lot of high power, mainly high power, long range bullseye style matches was everything was bullseye. While on the team, I was able to kind of push PRS a little bit, but it ebbed and flowed with who the officer in charge was at the time. My billets while I was on the team, I started off as a instructor competitor for my first year. And then my second year on the team, I was assigned as the head coach for the precision rifle team. So my next two seasons, my job essentially was coming up with the training curriculum, training the team, preparing them for competition, and then setting up the curriculum and training for the clinics that we taught for the juniors at nationals. And then we had visiting junior clinics that we put on every now and then as well. The big thing with high power is it absolutely contributes a lot towards PRS. Just like with three gun and USPSA, it gets downplayed a lot. People think it's stupid, it's boring, whatever the excuse is. Absolutely, it is those things, but it literally just filters down the skills to the barest fundamentals. And if you cannot master them, you will not succeed at those disciplines. All right. It's same with bullseye pistol. It's very different than USPSA, but it's very easy to take a bullseye pistol shooter and teach them to shoot faster. It's very hard to take someone who's been shooting fast for a decade and get them to be extremely precise because they're different skill sets, right? So they all play into each other. And that absolutely shows with who the champions are. Right. One of the big names in PRS, mainly rimfire, but also in centerfire right now, is Chris Simmons. And he just won the world championship for rimfire in Italy this year. I'm pretty sure he's also been selected for the centerfire team. That's Worlds is coming up this year as well. Phenomenal shooter in both regards. Got his start in small ball because those skills directly translate. There are tons of top level competitors that got their start in small bore or got their start in archery or got their start in bullseye pistol, depending on the discipline they got into, that started with something that was just the barest fundamentals. And then they transitioned to a discipline where you get to kind of relax the fundamentals in one hand while you pick up speed and transitions in the other, right? Because they are different.
I tend to call that acceptable accuracy.
Absolutely, right? Like if you're shooting a USPSA match and you've got paper targets, I don't need the rounds to be touching. Like the shot holes don't need to be touching. I just need to be somewhere in the A zone or in the A box, right? If it's three gun, I just need to hit minute of man so I can throw or have acceptable loss of fundamentals as long as I still get the hits within the acceptable range. But I definitely think that the high power side is a huge contributing factor to how successful I've been with PRS, both rimfire, centerfire, and with the sniper matches I've been getting into.
No, awesome. So, what would you say were some of your fondest memories that you had while on the team, and who do you keep in contact with the most from that period of time?
Oh, definitely traveling to shoot matches. It was awesome being on the range every day, but getting kind of away from the flagpole a little bit, traveling with the team, and getting to demonstrate what all of our effort was doing was an awesome experience. It was also nice because it's a military unit. So we did have a fairly cohesive team, and that did translate to us being able to go out and have a good time on the town on nights because all the matches are on the weekends. So we got to go party and have a little bit of fun as well. And those are probably the fondest memories I have of it, especially when we went to Nationals. I know there's mixed feelings about the Bullseye teams going to Nationals because it was a really big budget draw. But we spent essentially almost an entire month at Camp Perry, Ohio, shooting at least one, sometimes up to two or three matches a day for the entire duration that we were out there, depending on what disciplines you shot in. And it really was an entire environment. And that is very, very difficult to replicate now that I'm out because I cannot afford to take a month of PTO or just non-paid time off to go do that. So that definitely is probably one of my fondest things about it. I do keep in contact with a lot of the guys I've shot with, not everybody, but a fair amount of them. Freddie Church and Cody Wynn are probably the two I keep in contact with the most. We have a kind of group chat. Cody is now actually on the Natty Guard team. And so he has been shooting long range and very successfully been competing for them as one of their main long range shooters, slowly getting into PRS as well. And then I on and off keep in contact with a lot of the other guys. Like we talked about Wynn Massinger and Snyder are going to be at NRA Worlds here in 2 months. And so I've already been talking to them. We're probably going to link up. We're trying to squad together. We'll see. And then there's a couple other guys, random Facebook messages here and there, just like any other military unit we used to be a part of.
Yep. Nope. I get that all. I try to do the same thing. I talk to Chris Scott still. We talk on a weekly basis. Sam Lorino, him and I talk a couple times a year. I talked to Williams last month, Chris Williams, and he's
Nice.
actually going to be coming out here to Virginia at some point to see somebody off that we know.
Oh, nice.
I try and do my part and maintaining that contact because like those were our boys and we were really close to them at one point in time.
Absolutely. And I would love to get more of them more involved in the industry. That was probably one of my biggest disappointments. So that's what my fondest memory was. My biggest disappointment with the team was how few of them kept up with the shooting sports after we left the team. Because we really had like the perfect kind of setup for
And
us to
resume.
transition flawlessly into the industry, whether that was through continuing to be a competitor and picking up sponsors, whether that was transitioning to a company if they had a facility near where we needed to be instructors or to be evaluators or things like that. And a lot of the guys really didn't capitalize on that. And that was probably the most frustrating thing for me. There's a few of them I would like to call out, but I'm not going to name names.
Oh,
But
come on.
Andy, Andy is one. I'm glad he's getting back into it now, but Andy,
I love Andy,
was at the pinnacle of prodigy when it came to shooting. He was the most frustrating three-gun shooter with Bullseye because he was really good at it and hated it. And would, like, when we were training for championships, and for those of you listening that don't know what the championship is, the championship match for the Marine Corps competitions, everybody, regardless of how they got to the match, was required to shoot high power with iron sights. And so prior to the match, we would do a class for the action shooting team and get them spun up on what was going to be expected. And Andy would sit there and tell us how stupid it was and how dumb it was and how the jacket was gay. And then aim center mass, get an X, look at us and be like, this is dumb. And then shoot a 10. And it's very frustrating because then you get other guys that also say the same things, but they're shooting like fives and sixes and sevens. And so we can talk shit back. Can't say shit to Andy because he was actually doing good. Really well.
Yeah, one of my fondest memories on the team, it was Marine Corps Championships 2019, shooting bullseye rifle. I suck at it. I'm blind as a bat, and I'm somewhere in the middle of the target point. But, I'm counting down. Okay, this one's my target. All right, I know which target I'm on. And, X, 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 10, 5, what the fuck? And then, the confidence shot and then get back. All right. X, X, X. And it was those flyers that just kind of screw you really, really hard. You rushed it. You got too much confidence. You thought you got yourself into a rhythm and then you fucked up. But
yep. And that's what makes high power addicting, because they're like, oh, you're going to go shoot next weekend. And all you can think about is that five. And you're like, I shouldn't have done that. I can do better. I'll just not shoot that five and I'll have a great score. And then you go back out and you do some other dumbass mistake. And so they're like, come back next weekend. Yeah.
But, what made that, it was miserable in many respects, but it did have its draws to it. One of the draws is, the person who was scoring my target point, like him and I got along really well. It was a guy, Justin Griffiths. He was one of the captains, and like he would see like I would be getting X's or not tens and nines, and then I'd throw a flyer and he's like, dude, what the fuck? I was like, I don't know, I'm just gonna keep on shooting, dude. He's like, how do you stay so relaxed? I was like, the shot's already fucking down, I can't control it, I'm just gonna reapply the fundamentals and keep moving on.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you can do.
Yep, absolutely.
But I'm not sure if you've kept up with any of the current events of the team, and pretty much everyone that was there when you served on the team are gone. And there's been a massive evolution with the team. Now they no longer are competing in high power, but they have switched over to 22 PRSA and PRS. How has it been watching that transition from the outside?
Painfully slow. Yes. I disagree with their decision, as most of the previous team members do, to completely get rid of Bullseye. Like I said, that was kind of one of my roles when I first showed up, was to help kind of start the PRS program. And then depending on who was in charge on any given week, they either funded it or took away the funding for it. And so that made getting into PRS very, very difficult. But I think getting rid of Bullseye is a huge detriment to the program, because once those skill sets are gone, there is no getting them back. That is not something where you can school somebody up in a year or 2 years and all of a sudden they're going to be proficient enough to either instruct it or to make doctrine around it or anything like that. So once those skill sets are gone, that's it. They're completely gone. They won't be able to bring it back. And so I think that was a mistake, but it is really, really good that they are now actually focusing on both center fire and rim fire. Because for anybody that is not familiar with the PRS kind of environment on the East Coast, center fire matches are far and few between. Most of them, kind of like three gun, require extensive travel, lodging, plant airfare. And it's hard to get any close. And for a dedicated team like the Marine Corps team, where funding is a constant battle, it can get very, very expensive. And so that was one of the reasons I was pushing heavily for us to get into rimfire when I was still on the team, was because those matches were accessible. I'm still living near Quantico, and I, like I said earlier, shoot about 30 matches a year. At least 20 of those are rimfire matches, and I don't drive over 3 hours anymore to a rimfire match. And I will shoot at least twice a month within 3 hours of my house. Centerfire, that doesn't exist. I will be at least 5 hours plus to a centerfire match unless it's at Quantico. I think they run matches quarterly now. So, four matches a year if it fits my schedule that I don't have to get a plane ticket and a hotel and a rental car and days of PTO and all this additional logistics, right? So centerfire, as phenomenal as it is, isn't the end all be all because it limits how much you can shoot. You really need to do both centerfire and rimfire just where the team is located.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get that completely. You know, Colonel Jones, who's the current CO of the battalion, him and I were talking, and he was talking about centerfire matches and like gas gun type matches, and he's like, I guess it's not that big, or there's not a whole lot of them like around. I was like, well, there are, and I mean, you got to think, you know, right now, especially right now, it's the wintertime, so there's not a lot of matches going on. I was like, but you have the Quantico gas gun matches here. You also have, I was like, you have the Geisley gas gun matches, and then you have, what's it called? The IWI does their gas gun matches up in PA too. He's like, oh shit, I didn't know about that. And, yeah, we're going to have to definitely look into that. And I mean, you know, I think that's really important, especially with the Marine Corps switching over to their, precision marksmanship course and basically creating designated marksmen. You know, that's a great way to get guys really good shooting a carbine at, you know, your middle distance target ranges. So
absolutely. And quantified performance is making kind of an uptick in the last 2 years. I know Peacemakers started running ranges or matches. Quantico did for a couple of years. I'm not sure if they're still running QP matches. But that's starting an uptick, and that would be a phenomenal thing for them to get into. Again, because they have all the equipment.
Yeah.
It doesn't require them to develop anything.
Yeah, and I mean, like, in talking to Colonel Jones, like, they're making really good gas guns right from the platforms that they use for the national match rifles. Mm-hmm. They're just converting them right over and throwing a scope on them, and it's like, all right, we have a gas gun. We can compete, and this is probably one of the best gas guns you're ever going to get because it's made for precision. It was made as a national match rifle, which requires you to have sub-minute of angle accuracy. I mean, I think most of those guns while you were there probably shot about quarter minute angle, if not,
probably closer to a half on yeah. average, just because we weren't yeah. able to do load development per gun. We did batch load development for mm-hmm. everybody. So I'd say we probably ran about a half to three quarters for most of the guns, but they all have to be like repetitive sub-minute. It wasn't yeah. We shot one group that was half and the rest for a minute. Like, it was a repeatable sub-minute gun. And yeah, essentially all they needed was thread the barrel, throw a break on it, and they would be a phenomenal DMR gun or anything like that.
So, I mean, I think it's really good that they repurposed those guns for that reason.
Yeah.
So we've been talking PRS, mentioning PRS throughout this entire episode. But can you give us a solid breakdown of what PRS is and what can you be expected to perform if you attend a PRS match?
Absolutely. So PRS is essentially the Precision Action Matches. It stands for the Precision Rifle Series. It is a company, and they run their own series. There's a few other regional series out there and just outlaw matches. But they all call themselves the PRS style, just so you know what you're getting into. But essentially, it's a hit-based scoring system, but with a max par time. So if you're used to par times with three gun or USPSA like that, it isn't a timed stage per se, but there is a max time allowed, and the score is entirely based off of hits. 99 times out of 100, there's also going to be round limits per stage. Every now and then, as match director will allow makeup shots or an unlimited round count for a stage. But typically there will be 10 rounds for 10 targets for a max score of 10 points. And that's it. And so if you miss, that point is gone. Similar to Bullseye. And then there's variations of different series coming out. Like Quantified Performance I brought up is a mix between time plus scoring and hits. And so essentially a lot of like Quantico, they would run a PRS match on Saturday, and then Sunday they would run a quantified performance match with essentially the same stages. They would change the target sizes a little bit, make them a little bit larger because it would be gas guns over bolt guns. But then the scoring is time plus, but with extremely heavy fail to neutralize penalties. Typically, it would be if you ran a clean stage, just one hit per target, you would be done in 15 seconds with a 90 second par time, but you'd be done in 15 seconds. But every fail to engage would be like a 30 second penalty. So if you just blast through it and you time out with half your targets left, like that one stage will drop you down to the bottom page of standings. And so there's some series like that that are coming out to keep an eye out for as well. But typically for PRS, if you're going to run a bolt gun match, which most of them are going to be geared towards bolt guns, you need a center for center fire. You need a rifle that's going to be under 1 minute of angle. All right. So if you're shooting a smaller group than 1 inch at 100 yards, that's essentially what you need. There is, like with everything else, a huge gear race to do better than that, but that's really the requirement. You're not going to run into a whole lot of matches that do smaller than one MOA targets. There's the unicorn match here or there that pride themselves on being difficult. That'll do it. But most of them will be 1 to 3 minutes of angle, depending on what you're shooting off of. Because this is not your granddad's long range match. You're not going to be prone. Out of a 10 stage match, you might have one stage that lets you go prone. Typically, it'll only be for one position of the stage as well. Very rarely will it be a 100% prone stage. Everything else, you're shooting off of some type of prop or barricade or platform, depending on what the match directors come up with. For what you need, apart from the rifle, you have to have a submachine gun, but you have to have a scope with a decent reticle. And what I mean by that is, in today's kind of technology, right, a mil hash or a mil duplex reticle is not it anymore. You have to have some type of Christmas tree reticle. Do not have a BDC. It can be in mil radian or MOA, just as long as you actually know what your measurements are and what they mean. But you do need some type of Christmas tree reticle, so that way you can call your impacts and you can make your adjustments. That's the biggest thing, is having a reticle, you can make your adjustments. Just due to the target sizes, a mil dot reticle where you're trying to do holdovers and hold wind is just, you're setting yourself up for failure. And then the only other really piece of equipment that's, I wouldn't say mandatory, but is leaps and bounds better than what most people have, is they need a type of what's called a barricade bag. Whether that's a game changer or a wee bad fortune cookie, there's 100 different companies that make them now. Just look for a barricade bag that helps you create a stable platform on whatever the prop is. But that's really all you need: a solid optic with a good reticle, sub MOA rifle, and then a barricade bag. There's a whole bunch of other equipment you can also add, but it's additional equipment. In terms of your knowledge, you have to know what your data is for your rifle. If you're going to shoot center fire, you need to have that data out to probably about 1,100 yards. If you're shooting rim fire, you need to have it out to about 350. But that is the next big thing. And that's not really so much equipment, because there's enough free resources out there to be able to do that without purchasing things. But it is a knowledge set. So if you don't know how to do it, you're going to have to seek knowledge from somebody. There are YouTube videos that show how to do it. One-on-one instruction or going to a course is definitely a huge benefit for that. But you have to know your data, and that is huge, because if you don't know your data, you're going to end up wasting a lot of money, particularly with center fire, sending rounds down range and digging a hole into the dirt somewhere, nowhere even close to your target.
Nice.
Yep. Yeah, that was a very detailed explanation. And I actually want to jump a few questions down, because you ended talking about ballistics data. It's huge in PRS, and it's got to be basically perfect down to the decimal. But Matt tells me that you bring your Kestrel out with you, but that you also print out all your data and bring it to the match. Is that something you still do today? And what's your logic behind it?
So I don't print out my data anymore. I do know shooters that still do that just as a paper backup. It's typically not going to be their primary source of data, but cell phones die. I've had actually one of my best performances at a match was my phone had completely crapped out on me the day before, and I pulled out a new phone and was making data up because I didn't have paper copies. And then when I reloaded the app on my phone, realized it didn't have any of my profiles for my rifle saved. And so that's why a lot of people still do paper backups or have a copy of it somewhere. So Kestrels is one thing that I'm actually an anomaly to the general consensus on what they are. I don't even own one. I use Ballistic software, the same software that Kestrel uses. I use the Applied Ballistic software. I just have their app on my phone. But Kestrel makes a phenomenal product. It has a lot of value, but in my opinion, it gets used as a crutch a lot, which is the main reason that I refuse to use one. So the big thing for Kestrel, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, is it's a wind meter and or a wind or not even wind, a weather station, right? It senses temperature, pressure, wind speed. It has a little fan on it to determine wind speed and wind direction. You can set it up with a compass. And that's what a lot of people use it for, is to help them with their wind calls. And then within it, it has the software to help with your ballistics, which is the biggest part about it, is the ballistic software. So once you have your data, most people end up using the Kestrel as a wind meter. And the biggest downfall to that is it means they're too hyper focused on the wind speed and direction at the firing point and not what's happening downrange, which, depending on the makeup of the range, can be a big issue. If you're used to shooting flat ranges, it's going to be pretty consistent from the firing point to the target, and that's going to give you a very accurate, very quick wind reading. If you're shooting on a more dynamic facility where you've got a ton of terrain, you may not have perfect berms or roads going through the range, the firing line wind, while important, isn't nearly as important as what is happening downrange. And so what happens is everyone just starts looking at their Kestrel right where they're standing, and they don't look 500 yards downrange where the wind is going to be affecting their projectile once it's slower, a lot more than what's happening right where they're standing. And so that's the big reason why I'm kind of the anomaly. I'm one of the few people that is like adamant against being obsessed with Kestrel.
So I got while you were on the shooting team, you were the head coach there for a while. And part of the job as a head coach, you're not as nearly much of the shooter. You're sitting behind your shooters, looking through glass, watching wind. And much like when you were a sniper, like one of the biggest jobs is observation. And when you have to take a shot, you have to be able to read wind. Is that why you would say you're one of those anomalies that doesn't necessarily use it as a crutch? Because I mean, you're very good at observation. You can read wind, and that was part of your job there. Would you say that's part of the reasons you keep that skill up?
Absolutely. And so that was one of the big things, especially for team bullseye matches. As the head coach, my job would be to sit behind the binoculars that we had between my two shooters, and my main role was giving them updated wind calls because they were looking through a 4.5 power optic for service rifle, and I was looking through 10 power Highlander spotting binos. And these are massive, absolutely massive binoculars with a huge field of view. If you're familiar with a bullseye target range, I could see a 10 target bank through the binoculars. It's very high quality glass. And so my job was to keep very precise track of pickups, letoffs in the wind, and letting them know when it was time for them to fire so that the wind condition was the same shot to shot. And so we had a system that we went through with that, but that was one of the reasons that I'm, like you said, kind of the background on why I may be against you being obsessed with Kestrel. I'm not against Kestrel. It's a phenomenal product. But it's because one of the things with service rifle is you could not have electronics up on the firing line. So you couldn't have a Kestrel on the firing line. If you were waiting for your relay, you could use one behind the firing line until it was your turn to go up. Then you couldn't use it anymore. So you had to be really good at calling wind based off of environmental factors, whether that was the wind flags or whether that was vegetation or reading mirage. And because I became so proficient with high power, I just continued with that. But like I said, that skill set is a lot more beneficial than reading an LED display on a Kestrel, because people get too wrapped up into that and they can't figure out why their wind calls are off. And it's because they're on standing on top of a hillside, shooting down into a draw, and they're reading a 15 mile an hour wind. But as soon as it leaves that firing line, it's 5 miles an hour. And so they're overcalling every every shot essentially, because they're too obsessed with where they're standing and not where the round is going.
Yeah, that's a really interesting breakdown. And I remember, man, the first time I did a Mic-Mic, it was Collyard. Yeah. He was talking about watching a dragon fly downrange and using that to call his wind, which I thought he was bullshitting us. But honestly, after listening to your explanation and listening to him talk, it completely makes sense. We've talked about a lot of the ancillary equipment, but if someone is looking to get into PRS, what is the usual entry level, possibly budget friendly rifle that someone might use? And then, if money isn't the issue, what would you recommend at this current point in your shooting career?
So for center fire, the options are actually becoming very, very numerous, especially in that more budget-friendly price point. You have to have a sub-minute gun, which again, luckily or not, I wouldn't even say luckily. It's just the nature of development with technology is becoming much, much more attainable on a mass scale. So one of the biggest recommended rifles, mainly because it was one of the first to kind of have PRS in mind for mass production, is the Ruger Precision Rifle, the RPR. The Gen 1s, I know you could buy it in 223, 308, 6.5. I think now they sell them in 308, 6.5, and 300 Win Mag. And they might have a couple of 6 mils in there. I'm not 100% familiar with what their offerings are now, but that is a relatively budget-friendly rifle. You don't really have to do a whole lot to it. It comes in a chassis. I'm pretty sure you can get it with an Arca rail pre-installed, or it's very easy to install one. And it has kind of everything that you need it to have. You just have to throw a good optic on it, get a barricade bag, and you're ready to go to your first match. The downside with some of the mass-produced stuff is they're hit or miss with quality control. I've had people that say theirs are phenomenal and they're solid sub-minute guns. I've had other people that have struggled to get them to shoot well because it's still mass production. But we're leaps and bounds ahead of where we were a decade ago when it came to precision rifles. A decade ago, you pretty much had to go to a custom builder and drop a lot of money to get a sub-MOA rifle, where now it's not a whole lot. Another really good one, I think it was Savage, partnered with, was it MDT? I think it was MDT, and they have a line of precision PRS ready-to-go rifles. I want to say they start at like $1,400, and they're sitting in a $900 chassis off the shelf, and it's the Savage 110 is what it's based off of. That's another solid option for new shooters. The downside with PRS, like this is our budget friendly. We're talking a $1,400 rifle. You probably want a $1,000+ scope. We're not. Th this is not a poor man's sport by any means. As with any shooting sport, right? USPSA three gun. I mean, USPSA is probably the most budget friendly, because you can run single stack, you can run production, but like three gun, yeah, it's you have to have three guns. It's not budget friendly. You need a ton of ammo, right? Even two gun, like okay, cool, we got rid of one shotgun. I still need, you know, a crap ton of ammo to go to a match, and two decent guns. We're looking at $1,000+.
Frank, how
So,
much did your infinity pistol cost?
oh
Just
my
under.
God.
What, you're asking me? Yeah. Yeah, just under 10,000.
God,
Yeah.
I thought mine was expensive. So yeah, once you get into open, if money's no issue, I mean, you can just keep adding zeros until you get tired. When it comes to center fire, if you want to go custom, you ask 10 different people, they're going to give you 10 different brands and 10 different gunsmiths. There's a lot of really solid options for semi-custom and custom action builds. I think we've reached the point where you don't necessarily need a full custom rifle anymore. Pre-fit barrels have become popular enough and prolific enough with enough different actions that a lot of people are getting away without even using gunsmiths anymore. And they're getting essentially a custom rifle build at the end of it. You just have to choose the right action that has pre-fits available from the right companies that produce a high quality product. And you can assemble it in your garage with very little skills for center fire. A lot of action types. Defiance was a big name for a while. Personally, I think they've kind of fallen to the wayside after their price hikes. They promised that it was due to materials and that everybody else would be following suit, and that was almost immediately proved wrong as like three other companies released actions for half the price at comparative characteristics. You've got Lone Peak, you've got Impact, American Rifle Company makes a solid one. They just came out with the Coup de Grâce, which for the price point, I think has the most features of any action you can buy on the market. That's what I run for my center fire rifle. I have mine was built by Voodoo Gunworks. They also build my 22s. But they recently got into center fire with the Coup de Grâce and their Morpheus action build. And it is a phenomenal product, especially for the price point.
I
And
always
you're
loved their Mausing Field. I thought that was a great rifle.
Yeah, the Mausing Field was great. I'd heard mixed things after they had had a lot of rounds through them because there's a lot of moving parts, and the Coup de Grâce is fairly similar. It's got a camming bolt on it, which helps with the ejection. And so the bolt handle actually shifts, it pivots in the bolt itself. It's not one solid piece like a Remington 700 is. And so you add more pieces, more parts can fail over time, but it wasn't like 100 or 200 rounds. I'm talking people were on their third barrel and then started having issues that you wouldn't typically see. But yeah, when it comes to doing a custom build, research is the name of the game. Just pick a company that you can get behind that supports the industry, that supports growing the sport, and not solely profit driven. And you're going to be very happy and kind of go from there. But yeah, budget friendly, I would look at the RPR, the Ruger Precision Rifle. The Savage 110 is a solid one. And then my only other recommendation is if you do look at something, which kind of goes against both of those, though, is find something that's a Remington 700 footprint. And I say the same thing for rimfire, because then if you do upgrade to that custom build later, you don't have to replace everything. If you start with a Savage and then you upgrade to a custom build that's a Remington 700, the chassis that you had is no longer viable. The trigger you had is no longer viable, right? The only thing you can transfer over is the brake and the optic. Where if you start with a Remington 700 pattern, now you can at least just put that better action, that better barreled action into the same chassis you had. You can transfer over your same trigger, and it's a little bit more simple.
Gotcha. Really great points. So, PRS ammo is center fire. The rim fire is a little less expensive, but I mean, shooting is expensive. Is there a dry fire version that you guys do for PRS?
Absolutely. So there's one main company they call it's called the Indoor Dry Fire System. And essentially what it is they have a kind of like one of those pull-up banners that you would see at SHOT Show with people's logos and names on them and stuff. But it has a image of a range on it with targets at different distances of different sizes. And then it comes with a lens cap that goes on the front of your optics so that it can parallax down to like 10 yards. And the concept behind it is you set it up in your basement, and you're still able to focus on those targets. I'm pretty sure some of their versions have the range, like the estimated range of what the target is, so you can dial your dope and then sight in and dry fire on the target, utilizing the props. And that's the biggest thing with PRS. There's a lot of obsession, like I mentioned earlier, with getting smaller group sizes. And getting the most accurate, most consistent load, or the most precise load, excuse me, the most precise load, the most consistent load, smallest group sizes. And then they don't dry fire positions nearly enough because in PRS, getting into and out of position quickly is the name of the game. Finding that acceptable accuracy. You're never going to have a quarter minute target. That doesn't exist. So shooting a quarter minute group really doesn't matter. It's going to hurt a lot of people's feelings, but it doesn't matter at all because you're never going to shoot a steel target that size. What you need to be able to do is shoot a sub-minute group from a prop, either standing on a barricade or kneeling on a barricade or sitting on a barricade or from a rope or a strap or whatever it is. If you can shoot a sub-minute group or even for most cases, a sub-2-minute group on those, that is going to be significantly more valuable to you than being able to put up a quarter-minute group on paper from a bench every time you shoot. I actually wrote an article about it for Long Range Tactics, comparing with the WEZ, which is the Weapon Employment Zone software from Applied Ballistics. The hit percentage between a quarter minute gun and a half minute gun on a target of one MOA. And statistically, there is zero advantage to running a quarter minute gun over a half minute gun if you can call, if you can't call wind. That is where the biggest difference is in your hit percentage is calling wind or having a consistent load, so your consistent muzzle velocity. Because the longer you go out, the bigger the variation is for muzzle velocity. But when it comes to ammo, there's a lot of factory options becoming available. I know this is kind of a little bit of a tangent. There's a huge misconception with PRS that you have to hand load. Obviously, you're going to have a lot of benefits to hand loading your center fire ammo. Rim fire is pretty much all factory. Center fire, you can hand load. There's a lot of advantages to it. There's a lot of factory options available now that are extremely consistent and reduces the barrier to entry for people to get into it. You can get the RPR or the Savage or another entry-level Remington 700 rifle and get either Hornady. Hornady has a whole match line for 308 and 6.5 that are phenomenal. Federal Gold Medal Match is still the gold standard within precision shooting. I know in Bullseye, a lot of guys still ran Federal Gold Medal Match 77 grain factory ammo for Bullseye competitive shooting. They shot some of the higher grain projectiles for long range as factory ammo, and that is precision is the name of the game, right? I personally run Federal Gold Medal Match for all my sniper matches. I was able to pick up a bunch of it on a really good deal, and to the point I couldn't even reload cheaper than it. I think I picked it up for like $1.10 a round. So anyone listening that's thinking about getting into it, do not think you have to reload, but yes, ammo is expensive.
Yeah, I've always assumed that all the PRS guys reloaded all their ammo. But yeah, very, very good points. So talking through all the matches that you've attended, what was your favorite match to be at? And it doesn't necessarily have to be the same. It can be exclusive. But what was your most notable performance?
So favorite match to be at would definitely be the Australian Skills at Arms meet. I was able to go to that twice while I was on the shooting team. I'm very disappointed that that kind of fell to the wayside, because the shooting team wasn't the main supporter of it. We would support the Mew, who was sending out a team. And then there was one year where there was a lapse, and then just due to turnover rates between officers on the team and whichever unit was at the Mew, from my understanding, I don't think we've been back since, which, I mean, the last time was when I went 5 years ago. But that was absolutely the most fun match. Mainly because it incorporated everything. It was essentially like the Marine Corps Championships, but on a larger scale, and it was an international competition. So Australia would put up a couple of teams from their different units, and then every other nation threw up teams. And so the Marine Corps would have a team, the U.S. Army would have a team, and then there would be teams from pretty much every country in the Pacific. And then other countries would send stuff out as well. So like UAE would usually send out a team. Canada would send out a team. I don't remember if Mexico was there the last year I was there, but it was a big international match. But it was also fun because then at night we were able to go and kind of socialize with like-minded individuals, but from around the world. And so that was definitely one of my most fun matches. Not my most notable finish, but one of my most notable finishes. Myself and Anthony Dottillo were paired up my last year going to it. We pulled off third for the international teams. For the sniper competition. And so that was probably my biggest international finish. And then on domestic side, my most notable finish would have been this year, actually, at the Real World Sniper Challenge. So that is a series based out of Texas. It's a sniper style match where you have to run bolt gun. You can run a gas gun. There's some rules around it, but it's essentially a precision rifle and a pistol. And then how the match director sets up the stages is you get a brief prior to the stage. How much time you have to plan based off the brief depends, but it's essentially mimics a mission brief. So we'll be given an objective that we have to get to, either a vehicle insert. Sometimes he does air inserts, or a foot mobile insert. We'll be given a time hack that we have to get to the objective on. And then we'll get a very vague mission description, whether it's identifying an HVT, whether it's eliminating an enemy patrol, whatever it is, but it's very, very vague. And then we go through and essentially conduct a mini mission, and then have to extract within a certain amount of time. And for this year, my two most notable finishes with it were back-to-back weekends. Actually, me and my partner went up for the last match of the series, and then the next weekend was the series finale. And so we won the match prior to the series finale, and then we placed second at the finale. And the unique thing with those matches is the way to get to the finale is invite only, and the invites go out to the top two teams from any of the series matches, which there's only three a year for the real world series. And then he sends out invites to the winners of all of the sniper competitions domestically. So the international sniper comp, all the National Guard sniper comp, the other, there's a couple other internal ones. I don't remember all the acronyms for all of them, but essentially the winners of each of those matches get invites to the finale. And so what happens is we have a very stacked kind of small group of competitors for the finale match. Typically, his matches only run between 6 and 10 teams. I think he had one that was plussed up to about 12 teams last year. So it's not a huge, large scale competition like the Mammoth Sniper Challenge, where there's, 87 teams stepping off at the beginning. The first match that we shot last year, I want to say there was 8 teams competing. But this is not just random Joe Schmo picked up a gun at Cabela's and showed up. These are fairly high level competitors. So that was probably my most noticeable finish, was the first place followed by the second place the next weekend.
Yeah, super impressive, dude, and congrats.
Thank you.
That's super cool. At this point, we've covered a lot of topics. We've talked a little bit about your time on the team and what you've been doing afterwards, but is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with at this point?
If you have any interest in long range, just show up, particularly with rimfire. I know I've talked a lot about center fire over the podcast, but rimfire is kind of my bread and butter when it comes to PRS and long range competition. And one of the big reasons for that is how accepting and helpful the group of shooters are. One of the big things that goes along with that is partially logistics, right? You're not going to show up to a PRS match and some guy is going to hand you a 6GT and $400 worth of ammo and be like, "Oh, you want to shoot this and like go through a quarter of my barrel life?" Like, that's not going to happen. Rimfire, barrel life doesn't exist. The ammo is so much cheaper that if you show up with nothing and you just want to see what a match is about, I guarantee you somebody is going to offer you a rifle and they're going to offer you ammo and they are not going to expect you to pay them back. They want you to show up and have a good time. And it's much easier to do that with Rimfire because things like ear pro aren't really required. Like, yes, the insurance companies will say ear pro is required because it's damaging, right? It's Rimfire. You can sit there and BS with your buddy behind the firing line without having to shout at each other. It's awesome. All right, center fire, you're kindly getting blasted or constantly getting blasted by the dude with a giant ass muzzle brake, right? So if you have any interest in long range shooting, but particularly in rimfire, just show up to a local match. Reach out to a match director, find out when it's happening, and just show up. Don't worry about bringing anything, just talk to people. If you have a rifle and you want to shoot, just show up and somebody is going to offer to lend you bags. Don't go and try and buy some random crap you found on Amazon. You're going to end up being upset that you paid money on it and then buying something else. And chances are you'll meet somebody at the match selling something that they had because they upgraded something else and you'll get it at a discount. So just show up with what you have, let them help you look through different people's scopes. Ask, obviously, and mess with other people's guns. See what you like before you go spend your money. But chances are, if you show up to a match, you'll get something at a discount that you'll be able to mess with before you purchase it and get hands-on. And you're going to be exposed to a very helpful community of shooters that want nothing more than the sport to grow.
Very well said. I don't run those matches, but I'm looking at Quantico Shooting Club's dashboard, and there's a PRS match in March, and then there's a Rimfire PRS in April. So if you are in the area, please check those out. Hit me up. I know the match directors, but yeah, definitely can put you in contact with the right people. But appreciate your time, and I thought this was a really good episode for our listeners. Let us know how we're doing, and we'll see you on the next one.